Accession number 26599, Reel 1.
John Krish, Reel 1. John, by way of an introduction,
yes.
I wonder if you could just say what you were doing at the outbreak of the Second World War.
I was evacuated to Leatherhead, of all places.
Where were you at the time? You evacuated from?
Oh, I beg your pardon. We lived in South London, in Herne Hill, and I was at school in South London, school in Brixton, called Strand School, which was part of King's College in London. And in 1939, we were evacuated to Leatherhead. And my school days were dismal. I was the last of four boys to go there, and the youngest by 7 or 8 years. And they had all made reputations. And none of them were there. Or one of them was still there for a term or so when I actually got there. And I was quite bright. I passed the 11 plus, not the 11 plus, the entrance exam.
Common entrance.
Yes, when I was 10, rather than 11. So I was bright. But the ghosts of my brothers were so dominant that everything I did in every lesson, almost with every teacher, was compared with what they had achieved. And in sport and academically, they were very successful. And so I was never accepted for myself, and that became more and more depressing. Until about the age of 14, 15, when I started to fight back. To that point, I'd become a comic in the class. It was the only way to survive, really, to be the form jester. And I was just getting to grips with being recognized for myself, and it was a struggle. And then we were evacuated, and the school fell apart. Education just didn't happen. The teaching at the other end simply was so disorganized. We were separated into various schools and just turned up and nothing happened. In fact, I spent a lot of the time swimming because there were no lessons. And so that hit me at a very bad point. And so after 3 months, I came back to London and got a job in an estate agent. I'd written in my best handwriting, having seen a thing in the Daily Telegraph that wanted a junior. I lasted a fortnight. 1 week of which was notice, because when I went to the interview with a man who, on reflection, I realized was very gay and fancied me, which I didn't realize at the time, and never made any advances, but it was unpleasant. Anyway, I told him that my maths was excruciating, and the first thing they did, of course, was to give me rent books to add up, which I made a right bollocks of, and so I was sacked. And then I went to work for Pete Crean's in Bermondsey.
These are the biscuits.
Yes, and as a clerk, or an assistant clerk. But all the time I wanted to get into the theatre where my brother I loved dearly, he was the second brother, I wanted to get into the Oxford Playhouse to be an assistant stage manager. And they didn't have a vacancy. And after about, less than a year at Pete Crean's, I remember I'd seen a film called Nightmare when I was 13, and it had never left me. And I discovered who made it. That was the GPO film unit. And that they had an office in London, in Soho Square. So I went there, ostensibly to ask for a job, and discovered they had moved to Denham. And so I got the name of the person who was responsible for employing people. And within a few days made my way to Denham. To my horror, I discovered there were police on the gate at Denham Studios. And I was very cheeky in those days, Paul. So I said I had an appointment with Dora Wright, whose name I'd got from Soho Square. It was a lie. And they let me through. And she was the production manager. And she and the producer, a wonderful man called Ian Dalrymple, was so amazed that I got past the police that they gave me a job on the spot as an assistant to directors and editors. And the very first film I worked on as an assistant, second assistant, as an assistant to the assistant director, was Target for Tonight.
And would this have been 1941?
Yes. That's right. Goodness. And by one of those strange coincidences, the man who directed Target for Tonight was the man who directed Nightmare, Harry Watt, a bully. But that was all right. I was there. And I went on to assist both directors and editors. And what was wonderful for me, is this relevant to what you want to know?
Indeed, yes.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, yes, this was the war, obviously. And what they were making was government propaganda.
And this was at Denham?
At Denham, yes. In the stables. And the thing that really made the difference for me, I'm going to cough. Excuse me. Away from the mic. Was everybody... Well, the first thing was that I was not seen as cheap labour. I was not seen as a runner. I was there to be trained. So I went away on a film to assist the director and then came back into the cutting room on the same film, which was amazing. And the other great bonus of being there was that there was no cynicism in the place whatsoever. In feature films, as I later discovered, it was almost entirely cynicism. But here they were, the directors and editors, and Ian Dalrymple, the producer, were there because they loved making films. Nobody looked at the clock. We worked 6 days a week, sometimes seven. And they gave me a schooling which I hadn't had at school, and a sense of family which I didn't have, because at home I felt very isolated, being the youngest.
Where was home at this time?
Home was still in Herne Hill, yes. And so I travelled from Herne Hill to Denham every day, and I got £1 a week in those days. But it was worth it.
Were you looking for a particular role at that time, or were you simply all and everything and happy to take whatever was offered?
Just that. Happy to do whatever I was asked to do. And everybody had an affection for me, which was nice. And I was cared for and fed, because they knew how little I was earning. And in 1942... I was called up. And so the films that I worked on at Crown were Target for Tonight, Coastal Command, The Pilot Is Safe, Ferry Pilot, Wavell's 30,000. And it was a wonderful start for me. So then I went into the army.
Was that a sense of resignation, did you feel that you would have liked to have stayed with the filmmaking units and make films?
Yes and no. Being Jewish and having seen what the Nazis had done to the Jews since 1933, I knew that I needed to do something about it. I did try to get into the Air Force, but I wasn't physically fit enough. I was a very political child because of being Jewish. I wasn't brainwashed into being it. You couldn't avoid it, being brought up in a Jewish family and being aware and having relations bringing over child refugees living with cousins of mine. It was very, very upfront, all that. And Kristallnacht and so on. And I remember I'd saved up for a cap gun and went to the shop and spent my pocket money and brought it home, and then saw on it made in Germany. And without needing to be told, and I don't think my parents would have put any pressure, but I went straight back and said, I can't have this because I'm Jewish. I mean, that is ridiculous. I was kind of 11. But that's how important it was to me. So when I went into the army, it seemed... I'm also a pragmatic person, so it seemed that that was what had to be done.
Did it make you a political soldier, do you think?
No. No, I think it didn't. I wanted to do what I was trained to do as well as possible.
Which was?
I was... The first 6 weeks I was sent, when I got my call-up papers, it said Alexandria, and I thought, bugger me, Egypt straight away. But it was Alexandria near Glasgow, the Dalmonach barracks, which were peacetime barracks, full of lime-washed walls and incredibly unwelcoming, sleeping on straw, on palliasses of straw. And my first memory of my first days was diarrhea, which is not a happy thing to have with the straw underneath you. But I learned to salute and to march, and then got posted to a light ACAC regiment in the Aldershot Command at the infamous Deep Cut, the very barracks where all the problems are. And that was I think it was the 5th Light ACAC Regiment. And I did 6 weeks there, and got a stripe and was kept on the permanent staff as an instructor. I was then selected for a War Office selection board to be commissioned. And I was still somebody with a lot of initiative. I mean, the same kind of initiative that got me past the police. So that when I took the weekend tests, I put myself in the leadership position. I mean, not wanting to be, but it was second nature somehow, that a lot of people held back on certain problems that had to be sorted out. And one in particular was my undoing. This was March, I seem to remember, February, March. And there was an initiative intelligence... what's the word? Puzzle. I don't mean that.
A sort of psychometric test or something like that. Was it an initiative test?
Initiative test, I suppose, yes. There was a river.
Oh, I see. Yes.
And there was a barrel of oil. And there were 3 planks, none of which were wide enough to make a bridge. And we had to get the barrel from one side to the other, and somebody had to get into the river, and that's what I did. As a result, about 3 weeks later, when I got back and discovered that I'd passed, I became very ill with what seemed, well, I didn't know what it was, but I was incredible headaches and the colour of this wall and unable to get up in the morning. And a very unsympathetic MO who thought that I was skiving, because the only real symptom I had was the headache, and anybody can have a headache. And I was an embarrassment when it came to inspecting the barrack room, if I was still lying there. And so the headaches got worse, I got very feverish, and it was decided that in the period that I was waiting to go to OCTU, Officer Cadet Training Unit, I should go home to recover. So I packed all my things up and put them in the store and got a pass and got the train from Waterloo, from Brookwood to Waterloo, and had to stand all the way and feeling unbelievably ill. So when I got home, I went straight to bed, and a doctor relation came round and said I must go to hospital. They thought it was rheumatic fever because I said I'd stood in the river for 20 minutes, you know, in March. And there was, my brother had also had rheumatic fever. So I was taken to King's College Hospital and got worse and worse and worse. Blinding headaches, incredible pain. And then a wonderful night nurse, staff nurse, suddenly realized that I probably had the worst kind of meningitis, meningococcal septicemia, because she saw that my back was beginning to arch. The result was that that was diagnosed. I had lumbar punctures, which were incredibly painful. And there was no penicillin or streptomycin in those days. There was only something called M&B, which stood for May and Baker, were the people who made it. And I was in hospital for 9 months. And I had 6 weeks. And one weekend it was thought I was going. The screens were put around the bed. The ward was told to be quiet. This was a military ward at King's College Hospital. My parents were called and they stayed apparently the whole weekend. But I didn't, as you can see. I'm still here. And then I was sent to a Red Cross convalescent home wearing one of those blue uniforms with a white shirt and a red tie, which was in Henley. And then I went back into the army. Having been A2 to start with, I was now C3, which is kind of barely warm. But the invasion had started. And so anybody who could walk was needed. And I went back into the regiment, but the only thing I could do was organize entertainments, which I did.
Here in the UK?
Yes, at Deep Cut. No, I went back to Deep Cut, yeah. And then I put in for a transfer to the Army Film Unit.
Had you become aware of the Army Film Unit?
Well, only because we had, before I had gone into the Army, we had moved from Denham to Pinewood, where the forces were, the Army Film Unit, the Air Force Film Unit, and the Navy were there, with the Crown Film Unit. So it had become a government studio. They weren't making any, I don't think they were making any films then. It was restricted. No, they weren't making any films because there was barbed wire all over the place and guards and everything. So yes, I'd become aware and knew people in the Army Film Unit before I was called out. That's right, I'd forgotten about that. And so I was sent to Matlock, which was a kind of distribution area. And eventually I was posted to Pinewood and made a... How are we going? Yes. And made a terrible mistake. I'd been given a travel warrant from Matlock to Ivor Heath. Now, I'd worked at Pinewood and I knew that nobody who went to Pinewood went to Ivor Heath. You went to Uxbridge and you got the bus, which is what I did, having gone via home, to discover that they'd sent transport to Ivor Heath for me. So the Sergeant Major, who was not film, he was Royal Army Service Corps, I suppose, running the admin side of it, was very angry. So that was my welcome. As a result of his anger, he put me on fire watching duty with Mike Lewis over Christmas. Mike Lewis, the sergeant, parachutist, cameraman, who was also Jewish.
That's right.
Yeah. And that was probably why we were put on duty at Christmas, because he thought that we didn't have Christmas. So it was not such a hardship, because Mike and I got on like anything. And I was put into the cutting room, of course, because I went there as an editor, although I wasn't an editor, I was an assistant editor, but I had persuaded them that I was an editor. And the cameras that we were looking at out in the corridor, the biscuit box, as it was known as amongst the Army combat cameraman, the Normandy, yes. Vinton, was it Vinton?
The Vinton Normandy.
Yes. Made specially for the war. Was not made very well. And I was saying that the door often didn't shut properly, or it wasn't shut properly, or if it was dropped, it got damaged, and it was very easy to get flare on the negative. And so for the first weeks there, I was in fact scratching on key numbers on the negative of all the stuff which was coming from the combat cameraman. Otherwise, there would be no way of of identifying it, because the fogging was right down the edge where the key numbers were, and you need the key numbers to cut the negative to. So, but then I was given a sequence to cut of this. We're now talking about the True Glory, which Carol Reed and Garson Kanin, the American, were directing. And I remember I had, the sequence I had was a very long sequence, which was the coming of the rain in France. How are we doing?
Yeah, yes?
There was a very big coverage of how it held up things in France. And I was given this sequence to cut. And I took it into the theatre for Garson Kanin and Carol Reed to see. And they liked it. And that was an amazing piece of confidence making for me. They didn't want any changes or anything. And you put that against this history of my of real suffering at school, of never being accepted and everything being criticized endlessly, and my position at home of being isolated and rejected by older brothers who didn't want a four-year-old hanging on, tagging along with them when they were, you know, 12, 13, 14. There was a whole area of my life where confidence was not around inside my system. So anything and everything that was genuine praise was very important to me and helped to make me feel needed, if that doesn't sound too sentimental.
Were you given, I mean, more or less, you know, your own independence to cut
that material? Absolutely, yes.
I mean, were you in any sense aware that it was a special film in comparison, say, to other perhaps films?
Well, yes, because it was stuff coming in every day from the front, which made it special, that people were losing their lives shooting it. Mm. And whereas in Crown, everything was reconstructed, even though they used non-professionals, here was something which was happening. And yes, I was very aware of how special it was. So, sorry. What were we going to say? No, I was just going to say.
I was going to say your involvement was in the whole production, or were you involved as an editor for a part of it, and there were other editors working?
Well, that's right. Each editor had a section to do. And when they did it, they had another section given to them. When I finished that section, I became ill again. I should not have gone back into the army after that, after the meningococcal septicemia. I mean, that is a killer. But I did. But one or two things which were pleasant about being at Pinewood with the Army Film Unit and the others. I mean, rank was very difficult. You didn't call anybody sir, and nobody saluted anybody. And the people in the RASC who were running it, running the admin for leave and passes and cookery and, you know, getting the food in and out and rubbish and whatever, all that side of it, I mean, thought that we were absolutely revolutionaries, you know, and did everything to make our life a misery.
Were you still carrying the one stripe?
Yes, yes. I was going to be given two more, because everybody was a sergeant who was an editor in those days. And
just as the cameraman was.
Yes, exactly. Yes, the editors were taken up.
And the assistant editors were two stripes, were they, or one
stripe? I don't remember any assistant editors. I really don't. We did it all ourselves. I think the assistant editors were from the ATS, who'd been neck cutters or things like that before. But the discipline was non-existent, except there was a morning parade, which was ridiculous, and there was some attempt at PT in the car park. I mean, it was grotesque. The theatres at Pinewood became notorious as knocking shops, something I didn't indulge in. I was in a show there. There was a drama society from all three units, and we were doing a play called While Parents Sleep, domestic comedy. And I played Richard Attenborough's father, because he was in the Air Force. But before the production, I became ill again and was taken back to hospital, back to King's College, where it was discovered that I'd got some kind of nervous problem. It was eventually called anxiety neurosis to get me out of the army, but I was having fits, rather like St. Vitus dance fits or epileptic. Not epileptic, I wasn't frothing, but I was not in control of my arms or my legs. It was as if I was fighting to get out of an invisible net.